Hi, I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio, where we talk about how to thrive in a toxic world and live toxic free. It's Thursday, October 9th, 2014, and it's a beautiful early autumn day in Clearwater, Florida. And we're going to be talking about why we shouldn't have nuclear power plants. Actually, here where we live, there's a strange thing going on, and I probably don't have all the details, but we are now paying on our bill to build a nuclear power plant. And that's not something that I think most of us want in this community. There's some problems with it, and maybe it's not going to happen, but I just would not like to see another nuclear power plant. So my guest today is toxicologist Dr. Stephen Gilbert. He's been on before, and in fact, you can go to toxicfreetalkradio.com and look for today's show. And at the end of the description of today's show, you can see all the shows that he's already done. We've talked about the basic principles of toxicology, how to determine your risk of harm from an exposure, toxics through history, the ethics of toxics, how, and then all kinds of chemicals. We've talked about endocrine disruptors, persistent bioaccumulative toxicants, how mercury affects your health, nanoparticles. Dr. Gilbert is just so knowledgeable about the whole field of toxics that I just have him on every month so that he can tell us more. Also, he has a wonderful website called toxipedia.org, and there's so much information there. I just found out today that they now have information about the toxic effects of various molds that you might find in your environment in addition to toxic chemicals. He has a wonderful book called A Small Dose of Toxicology, which is free. You can go to toxipedia.org and get that book for free. I do want to say that the easiest way to get it is to just go to toxicfreetalkradio.com and click on the book cover. It'll take you right to the page. So, Dr. Gilbert, hello.
Hi, Deborah. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Good. It's a little foggy here in Seattle, Washington.
Foggy in Seattle, Washington. Well, isn't that kind of typical of autumn?
Yes, it is. We're moving into our rainy season here.
Yes, we're moving out of our rainy season. I think it's going across the country over to you. So tell us about nuclear power plants.
Well, there's about 100 nuclear power plants operating across the United States, and they generate about 20% of our total electric bill. Our power that we're generating. But I think you really have to ask, you know, how this came about and to look at the history of nuclear power and to understand its impact. And the other thing to remember is a lot of these nuclear power plants are aging. There hasn't been a new one built since the 70s, although there are a couple under construction. I think Florida's got 5 nuclear power plants. Most power plants are concentrated on the East Coast. So I think they have to ask, are they safe to operate? What are we doing with the waste from them? Are they economically feasible to operate? And what are we doing for the future? How are we using this to combat climate change and to produce more and safer power?
Well, let's start with the history. There's a lot to talk about. So let's start with the history. How did the first nuclear power plant get to be built?
Well, it started off in World War II, actually, was the beginning of this, when the atomic bomb was developed and that generated nuclear plants, mostly reduced plutonium. Hanford, Washington was one of the major sites for that, as well as Savannah River. And they built nuclear plants. Just the sole purpose was to generate plutonium and extract plutonium. So they used uranium. They mined uranium-235, made fuel pellets, and the tremendous amount of heat that's generated from these power plants, well, what do you do with all that heat? So there was thought immediately to capitalize on the investment that the military was making in nuclear plants to reduce plutonium, was could we generate electricity? Could this turn into Atoms for Peace program, which Eisenhower promoted? In 1951, the first power plant actually was in Idaho, produced a little bit of electricity and turned on 4 light bulbs. So it wasn't until 1951 that nuclear power actually turned on light bulbs and actually generated some usable electric power. And from there, they tried to commercialize that. There were bills passed. And nuclear power has a long history of being subsidized by the government, first through the military, and then through outright loans to power plant construction people and developing new designs. in trying to make nuclear power feasible. One of the most important things was the Price-Anderson Act in 1957 that said that reduce the liability, so it made the companies not have to assume the liability of any accident that occurred. And this was huge. It's the only industry in the United States where the government assumes the liability of commercial operations of power plants.
Wow. Wow. So there's the responsibility is separate from the person or the organization who's actually taking the action.
Correct. So there were at one time there were 253 power plants ordered. We're down to 100 operating power plants. And the thing to remember is that all these are aging power plants. In 2013, four plants were shut down across the United States, and there's efforts to shut down more of them.
Are they being shut down because they're unsafe?
Well,
or just because they're old?
I don't think the industry would say they're unsafe, but they're having problems with other operation. They've just become uneconomical to operate. They have problems with the condensers that generate the steam. So you have to remember, these power plants are really just a hell of a way to boil water. All you're doing with nuclear power is boiling water.
Tell us how a power plant works, a nuclear power plant works.
Well, nuclear power plant has a nuclear reactor in it, and that reactor uses uranium-235 as its fuel, and it'll produce neutrons, and those neutrons bounce off the uranium-235 and split it into other elements, and those are many elements are radioactive. For example, cesium and strontium are some of the isotopes that are developed when uranium is split, and that splitting those atoms, that fission creates enormous amounts of heat. So you capture that heat, you turn that heat into steam, and there's various schemes to do that. And that steam is used to turn the generators and produce electricity. So it really is, nuclear power plants are just one big boiling water reactor where they boil water to make steam to produce electricity. And the problem is, one of the problems that I just sort of alluded to was that they produce a lot of waste. So the power plants produce spent fuel rods, and those fuel rods are very hot. They produce a lot of heat still, and they have to figure out what to do with them. One of the biggest problems is we do not have a way to deal with the waste produced by nuclear power plants. There was one time going to Yucca Mountain, but that was shut down. And now the nuclear power plants have most of the waste product from these power plants is stored on site. And the question is, how safe is that?
So how would we... I understand what you're saying about the environmental effects and the long-term effects and all those things about the waste. But how are nuclear plants affecting us as individuals as we go about our daily life?
Well, I think that if you're nearby one, you have the direct effects of that. You have potential to be exposed to accidental occurrence at the plant, like Three Mile Island, if you're around that plant, or Fukushima, or Chernobyl, where they contaminated large swaths of land, had many thousands, hundreds of thousands of people even evacuated from the area. So there's the risk of that. There's also, all nuclear power plants emit a little bit of radiation, so there is some potential for exposure to that. And there has been some studies showing that there's increased incidence, for example, some leukemias from being nearby a power plant. But so that's the direct effect. I think we also have to look at the long-term consequence of nuclear power, how these plants, what happens when they age. They have to be disposed of. They have to be decommissioned. That's a problem. It takes enormous amounts of energy. And one thing that nuclear power proponents say is that it's a green power. It's carbon neutral, carbon free, actually. And that's really not the case. It takes enormous quantity of energy to build the power plants. It takes enormous energy to enrich the uranium-235. And decommissioning these power plants takes another huge amount of energy. Actually, more energy it took to build the plant to decommission it. Because you have to cut it up. You have to let it sit around for a while. So nuclear power plants are not carbon free. And you have to be thinking about that as far as climate change goes and other ways to produce energy and electricity.
We need to take a break, but when we come back, we'll talk a lot more about nuclear power plants and how they affect our health and the environment. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Datt, and my guest today is toxicologist Stephen Gilbert, PhD, and his website is toxipedia.org. He's the author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, which I have many times said that everybody should read because it will give you some really just great basics about the field of toxicology. We'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dowd, and my guest today is toxicologist Stephen Gilbert, PhD, and he's the author of A Small Dose of Toxicology and has an incredible website about toxics called toxipedia.org, which you should go to and explore in great detail. Anyway, I always find something interesting when I go there. So,
and one of my, I have a chapter on radiation for those that want to learn a little bit more about nuclear issues and understand the effects of health effects of radiation. There's a chapter of that along with a PowerPoint presentation about radiation.
I'm opening your book right now. Anyway, I will open your book while you talk. So tell us about the economics of it, of nuclear power plants.
Well, the economics is really interesting, and this is where one of the biggest failures of the nuclear power industry is, in my view, is around economics. And I'll just read you a little quote that from 1985 from Forbes magazine, and Forbes magazine is one of the big economic proponent magazines. And remember that this, that the U.S. government subsidized these plants in form of loan guarantees that I mentioned earlier, the Price-Anderson Act that provides liability insurance to these power plants. But here's a quote from Forbes magazine, 1985. Remember, Three Mile Island was in 1979. It says, "The failure of the U.S. nuclear power program ranks as the largest managerial disaster in business history, a disaster on a monumental scale. Only the blind or the biased can now think that money has been well spent. It is the defeat of the U.S. consumer and the competitive U.S. industry for the utilities that undertook the program and the private enterprise system made it possible." So really, and I would say the government's involvement in it too, it really is a damning statement about the effects of the economic viability of nuclear power. I'll just give you one more example of this. In Washington State, they had the WHOOPS program, where they planned to build five nuclear power plants. And they had a big bond issued in billions of dollars. And they shut down two of them. Two of them they started to build and abandoned. And only one of the nuclear power plants, the Columbia Generating Station, was actually completed. The ratepayers in Washington State are still paying for this program called WHOOPS. And it was the largest municipal bond failure in U.S. history, was around the nuclear power industry. And now, in the West Coast here, we have a new, what they think is an economically viable situation, a small modular nuclear reactor. So I'd encourage your listeners to pay attention to the small modular thing. Again, they're looking for government subsidies to get this thing going and build smaller nuclear power plants, which they say will be economically viable. Very few of the plants, the vast majority of plants when they're built, went over budget. So the many plants they built cost up to 200% more than they planned to build. So you plan to build a plant for $1 billion, it costs $2 billion. This is, then they're delayed in opening. This is what happens to a couple that are under construction in the United States right now. They're all delayed opening and operation. So economically, the bottom line is, it always surprised me that our physical conservative and people that are, you know, are promote capitalism, promote physical responsibility, are willing to tolerate an industry that cannot exist without government subsidies.
Yes. Well, government subsidies, that's a whole big subject in itself, all the things that the government is subsidizing. So you had said earlier that the last one was built in, what, 1973? And that there's just under construction. Like they're talking about building one nearby where I live. I mean, not in my backyard, but that would be serving. It would change my power source to nuclear power. I actually, you know, I just like to interject here that even if you're on the grid, that you can do, what are they called? Green power certificates or something like that, where you can actually buy green power that, like solar or, wind, you know, different kinds, you can choose your power and it offsets your usage, so even though you're still using the grid power, somewhere in the world you're paying for green power to be used. And that's a way that you can offset your use if you can't go to solar or do something on your own property. then at least that that's something that you can do. And so there are things that we can do to promote the use of energy technologies that are not nuclear. I just think that it's a bad thing all around. Anyway,
agree with you more. I think Florida's got some great advantages. You've got tremendous solar capabilities. And I think in Florida, they really need to have better incentives putting solar power on homes. I just put solar power on my house here in Seattle, Washington. And since July, I've generated over 3 megawatts of power, and it sold over 1.75 megawatts back to our Seattle City Light.
So it's right. I just love that.
It can be very exciting to then be engaged in producing power. So we really do not need nuclear power plants. We focus on conservation and alternative sources of energy generation. And there's lots of data on that.
Yeah,
when you look at the cost of Fukushima and what happened to Fukushima and the three power plants melted down there, as well as dealing with the waste.
It just when you, especially with Fukushima, because that's something that we're living with now. Earlier in my lifetime, we went through Chernobyl. Earlier than that, we went through Three Mile Island. You know, it's like I can think of three off the top of my head just in my lifetime of where there's been massive amount of radioactive material going into the environment because of nuclear power plants. And they're just not necessary. They're not necessary because we have other ways, other less toxic ways of producing energy. And it's just an option that doesn't need to be there. You know,
it's right. And you got to remember the power plants, you know, they serve their accident rates sort of on a U-shaped curve, where the most vulnerable time for nuclear power plants is when they're first starting up, the first couple of years of operation. Then they go sort of a quiet period where things are working well. And then they age, there's an increased probability of accidents. Like the Fukushima power plants were old-style G Mark I reactors that have known problems with them. And they lost the coolant that has to require to cool those reactors. Even if you shut them down, they're very hot. And they just continue to produce heat, which created a meltdown of the three reactors at Fukushima. And there's also
We need to go to break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about that, because I want to hear about what's going to happen as these reactors start aging. So this is Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dagg. My guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert. His website is toxopedia.org, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dagg, and my guest today is toxicologist Dr. Stephen Gilbert, PhD, and he's the author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, and his website is toxopedia.org. So before the break, we were talking about what's happening with the aging nuclear power plant. So let's talk more about that, because as they're starting to crumble, what do you think is the future of nuclear power? Because do you think that they will repair these plants? Do you think that they'll continue to build more? Or do you think that it's all just everybody's going to decide it's a bad idea and stop?
You know, I would like to think that people are going to come to the conclusion this is a really bad idea. And I think more and more people are reaching that conclusion. What you've seen, though, with nuclear power plants is the owners want to extend the license of these plants for another 20 years and can operate them beyond their design capabilities. So what happens when you expose material to radiation, it becomes more brittle. So the plants become more vulnerable to failure. And that failure can occur in a number of ways. For example, an earthquake, you know, which ultimately damaged the reactors of Fukushima. But we just did an earthquake study of the Washington State Reactor, the Columbia Generating Station, and found that seismically it's not fit to be operating because of danger of a nuclear earthquake in that area. And this has been well documented. We have a big cleanup operation for the Hanford nuclear site. The vitrification plant was retrofitted for earthquake potential. And they never did that with the plants there. And the plants do get more vulnerable as they age. Another vulnerability is also flooding. I know one plant along the Mississippi, they knew the water was going to rise down there, but you can, there's some great pictures on the web with this plant just surrounded by water. Remember that Fukushima, that's when it really damaged that plant, was when the tsunami waves came in there and flooded the backup generators and shut the plant down. So I think you got multiple vulnerabilities here. aging is one of them. The plant that Vermont, the Yankee plant in Vermont, was leaking tritium into the groundwater, and that's from leaking pipes. And they spend a lot of time trying to figure out where that is. Vermont's trying to shut that plant down, and the industry fights to keep it open. Remember, you know, they've made their capital investment in these old, aging nuclear plants, so they're looking at the profitability of electricity they're generating. But even that, you look at Columbia Generating Station, Washington State, we looked at the economics of that, and it's not economically viable given the cost of uranium to refuel those reactors. And remember, these reactors had to be shut down for about 2 months, 40 days or so on average, a little bit less sometimes, every year and a half to be refueled, and that has to have to deal with sourcing that uranium and then packaging it in fuel rods. So that's very expensive to do, and it was determined that in this Columbia Generating Station we could save billions of dollars by abandoning this plant and moving to other sources of energy. So I think we really, in the long run, nuclear power is not viable, but you can see that with the very few that are on order, and just a couple being built in the United States, and these, like I mentioned, are over budget and behind time. So I don't think they're viable. The latest thing to try, nuclear industry, to try to make them economically viable and deal with the waste through these small modular nuclear reactors.
And do you think that those small modular nuclear reactors will be the future?
I don't. I think they suffer from the same problems of the industry components say that because they can manufacture, they produce about 300 megawatts of power. They can be sited at different places. They're easy to build, cheaper to build. But it's really not the case. They have the same vulnerabilities. Still, you need enriched uranium to run them. They still have to deal with the waste. And waste is a huge problem. So the waste that comes out of these plants, when you burn these fuel rods, they become very hot and contaminated with nuclear waste. Cesium and strontium just being two of them. And you have to put them someplace. So you pull them out of the nuclear reactor, and they cycle these things in. They replace about a third of the fuel rods on a fuel cycle and put in new fuel rods with fresh uranium-235. And they have to store them in large pools, essentially big swimming pools, that in the water dissipates the heat from these fuel rods and keeps the neutrons from exciting more reaction. So where does this stuff go? They've gradually, because these older plants continue to produce fuel rods, I think there's like 65,000 tons of spent fuel, and the big problem is where to put it. So they store in these ponds, these big swimming pools, and the old Mark II, one and two star reactors, there's several floors up in the air. And this was a big problem in Fukushima because the reactor number four had all their fuel rods out of the reactor at the time, which seems like a good idea. To know that it's way up in the air, and if that earthquake had damaged that fuel and leaked the water out of those big swimming pools, those fuel rods can burn. They can start burning, produce hydrogen, and they can get an explosion from that, and you actually, they could distribute more radiation from the fuel rods than it in the reactor core. So it's a huge problem. So they take these fuel rods, they put them in dry cast storage, is one of the solutions, but they have no place to move these dry casts, no place to dispose of them. And I think that's one of the biggest vulnerabilities of nuclear power, is we do not know what to do with the waste. And we are generating waste that will be around for many generations. And I just think that's irresponsible. We should not be burdening future generations with spent nuclear fuel that we do not know what to do with, and it creates a hazard wherever it is.
One of the things that we've talked about a little bit on this show is that my basic foundation of thinking has to do with look at nature and see how life works and mm-hmm. how close can we come to that. And that's really my standard is, can something be in the cycle of life? And so when you have something like nuclear waste, which is extremely toxic, it's extremely harmful to everything, and it cannot go back into the cycle of life. It just piles up and piles up and piles up, just like probably most people are more familiar with landfill problems, where you have things like plastic that doesn't biodegrade. I mean, they put them in the landfill, but that doesn't mean it's going back into the cycle of life. And the way the cycle of life works is if you imagine a tree, and it produces leaves, and the leaves then fall down. I mean, the leaves do what they do. They do photosynthesis and help the the trees live, and they provide shade and food and all kinds of things for their little local environment. And then the leaves fall off the tree and they go back on the ground and they build soil. And so at every point, what's going on is that elements and nutrients of life are exchanging forms with each other. And nuclear elements can't do that. They don't do that. And so what they do is that they harm life around them instead of going back into that cycle of life. And that's what I'm most concerned about, I just think that anything that can't participate in that renewable cycle of life is things that we shouldn't do. We need to go to break, but when we come back, we'll hear more from Dr. Gilbert about nuclear power plants. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is toxicologist Dr. Stephen Gilbert. And his website is toxipedia.org, and he's the author of the book, A Small Dose of Toxicology, which you can get for free on his website. Again, that's toxipedia.org. And Doctor, we're talking about nuclear power plants. During the break, I looked up what was going on with my local nuclear power plant. And in fact, I thought I kind of heard this as I was walking through the room and there was a television on the other day. I actually don't read the newspaper and all of those kinds of things, so I don't always know what's going on in the world. But what happened is that very recently this proposed nuclear power plant, that the whole project was canned. So they're not putting it up. This one is done. What I found was an article saying that one of our legislators has, a representative, has proposed that all the $54 million that have been collected from us for this nuclear power plant should be refunded to the public. And I'm very happy for that.
And I'll bet that never happens, because the power companies already invested a lot of money in design and working on that thing. So they've incurred a whole bunch of expenses that the ratepayers often end up paying for. And nuclear plants have also got this great thing where they can pay forward. So you, for years before the plant is built, you actually start paying for it in your rates, your electric rates.
Yes, yes.
It's a very nice deal for the power companies. I want to mention more hazard about the nuclear power plants is proliferation of the knowledge. And for example, the Ukraine, and I think everybody's aware of the political problems in Ukraine, the fighting that's going on over there, has 15 nuclear power plants. And who do you want owning these power plants? Because they can't produce radioactive waste that could make dirty bombs, and you do not want terrorists or other people that have other issues controlling these plants. And you look around the world and you see North Korea, Iran, Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility produced a great report about a nuclear famine that, with the example that if India and Pakistan got into an exchange of nuclear weapons, billions of people could die due to agricultural failures around the world. So I think just from that perspective, it's another reason why nuclear power is not a good thing to do around the world.
I completely agree with you. Just on every level, it's not a good thing. And especially, well, tell us more reasons why people should use solar or wind or other alternatives, because they do exist. And why do you think, besides economically, is there some reason why we just aren't just everybody going to these other types of energy that are obviously so renewable and less polluting and a much better idea?
Well, one reason, in my view, is that electrical power companies control the grid, and they do not want to make the investment to allow energy to put back on the grid. We're very fortunate here in Seattle that our power company is pretty progressive and allows us to sell power back to them. Many places, I believe Florida is an example of that, they put a lot of barriers up to putting solar power back onto electric grid. If the grid companies would focus on conservation and investing in the grid so that we could take power from individuals, but that's decentralizing the power generation. And these power companies make money from selling electricity from large investments they've made in either coal-fired plants or nuclear plants and large generating capacity. So I think one thing that listeners can do is contact your representative, say you want better incentives for solar or wind power, and move to renewables and get away from coal and nuclear power as a source of generating electricity. We need an entirely new model for generating power, which is individual. And look what Germany has done in that regard. They've shut down most of their nuclear reactors and are moving towards a more decentralized power production model. And that involves all of us getting involved. Another thing we can do individually is conservation, move toward LED light fixtures that really reduce the amount of watts. And the solar power I have on the house, I can actually have this neat technology called E-Gate that lets me monitor my power use and the power I generate from my solar panels. And I can literally watch, as I turn a light on in a room, how much power that light's consuming. It's really opened my eyes up.
Very cool. But, oh, I love that.
I'll send it to you, Deborah, so you actually take a look at that. But it's really neat to see that. And it really drives home the fact that these old incandescent lights are very energy hogging, and we can switch to much reduction in power we use individually as well if we want to make the investment move towards solar.
I have a little gadget that I actually, I'll admit that I've never used it, but I just came across it the other day because it's just, it's a technical thing and I'm not a technical person, but it, I don't even know if they're still sold. It's called Kilowatt, K-I-L-L-A-W-A-T-T with hyphens. And it's a thing that you can, put in, you unplug your plug, your cord, and then you plug in this device and then you plug your cord into it. And it'll tell you how much energy you're using. But I like yeah, it is. And so my idea was that I was going to go around, I was going to test the energy and everything in my house. I actually do save a lot of energy. I don't use a lot of lights. I don't even have overhead lights in most of my rooms. I just use little task lights.
Very good.
Yeah, I just got a new air conditioner that's much more energy efficient. I'm about to get a water heater next week that is going from electric to gas. And so one by one, I'm replacing all these things and not looking at what the individual energy use is. But I love the idea of what you just described, that you can turn something on and see how it's really affecting in real time what's going on with your energy use. And if we had that awareness, if people, I think a lot of it just has to do with not being aware. Number one, not being aware of what is your energy? Where is it coming from? Where is it coming from?
I think that's a really good ask everybody that we need to be more aware of that, because the power companies remember make money by selling electricity. So they don't have a lot of incentives to reduce electric consumption. Their whole business model is making money from selling electricity. And we really need to move more toward a conservation model. I really admire you for making the effort to reduce your electric consumption by changing some of your devices and monitoring some of its use.
Thank you. So we need to know, number one, where our energy is coming from. And anybody can just pick up the phone when you stop listening to the show today. Just go straight to the phone and call them up and say, what is the source of the power that you're selling me every month? And the number two is, where are you using that energy? I mean, it's like there's all these things that we really need to be aware of, like what's our energy use? What's our chemical exposure? How much money are we spending? Yep. How many fattening foods are we eating? We need to like be looking at these flows that are going through our lives and control them, be aware of them and use them to our best advantage. And if you know that you're using a lot of energy and if you know that it's causing pollution on the other end, this is something people think that electricity is so clean. Well, it might be clean in your house, but it's not clean on the other end. And
it's really not. I think, on the West Coast, we're fighting coal trains, and they want to ship a lot of coal to China. China produces electricity from coal-fired plants. A lot of them do not have pollution control device on them. There's mercury in coal. The mercury gets in the atmosphere. It ends up in the fish we eat. So we're very directly connected to the energy we produce and the coal production and the use of coal as an energy source. For example, just with the mercury that's produced, and we know how to stop that. And there's been a huge effort by the U.S. EPA trying to curb the pollution that comes from coal-fired plants, which I really admire. But that's been a huge uphill battle because the power companies, again, do not want to attach pollution control device to their power plants because they're not making any money from doing that. They want to build more power plants.
Well, I think that the motivating factor, we've talked about ethics in another show, but I think that there needs to be this huge shift that goes from money and profit being the determining factor about taking actions to having sustaining life be the sole determining factor. And that we need to, everybody at every level of life, the individuals, manufacturers, retailers, government, doctors, everybody needs to be saying, what can we do to sustain life? And then how do we make money doing that? Instead of,
we're not doing that when we produce nuclear power, which generates hazardous waste. Most hazardous substance on the world are generating nuclear waste. Remember, there's plutonium in this nuclear waste, as well as cesium, strontium, and a whole bunch of other isotopes. So we're generating something we don't know what to do with that's going to be hazardous to future generations. We really need to be focused all the time on what is best for the future generations, for our children and grandchildren and their children.
Yes, yes. Otherwise, we're not going to have a planet. They're not going to have a planet. And, you know, I think that probably in our lifetime, you and I, Dr. Gilbert, that we will, probably life will be the way it is now. I can project that. But I think for children and grandchildren that the world is not going to be the same. And
it's not far. It's hugely vulnerable to sea level rises, which is happening. And there's going to be enormous flooding along the coast of the United States and around the world. And it's going to create great disruptions of people and really a lot of suffering worldwide.
And we can, there's so many things that we can do about it right now today to have a different future. Anyway, I want to thank you because we're almost out of time. Another great show. You always have great information. And again, Dr. Gilbert's website is toxopedia.org. And you can also go to toxicfreetalkradio.com. And see all the other shows that, or listen to all the other shows that Dr. Gilbert has done, as well as other shows that have been on. All the shows, all are in the archives. You can listen to every single show that we've already done, and you can find out who's going to be on next. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio. Be well.